Autonomous vehicles, or AVs, are supposed to relieve our world of crashes, pollution, traffic congestion. They've done none of those things on their long-time horizon. We're talking about the future of car dependency in America on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are about 37,000 traffic deaths a year in our country. Here in Wisconsin, 566 people lost their lives in fatal crashes in 2019. That's federal data there. And the AV industry cites stats like this as a big motivator to get high-tech advancements to replace humans who make dumb risks behind the wheel. So what future do you want to get from point A to point B? Have you been a passenger in a driverless vehicle? What was that like? 800-642-1234. Peter Norton is an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. His new book is called Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. Peter Norton, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here, Kate.
So for the vast majority of us, we've never been a passenger in an autonomous vehicle, perhaps never will. What was it like for you to take a ride in one?
Well, it was both interesting and a little boring. It was interesting in the sense that, yeah, I could watch a steering wheel turning on its own as if by a ghost's hand. At the same time, it was pretty underwhelming because it was on a closed parking lot that was roped off with warning signs to people to stay away. So, and the vehicle was going very slowly on a closed course. So in a way, it was like a low thrills amusement park ride.
What year was this?
That was 2019.
2019. And so, you know, you really reach back into the history here. But before we look at this history, language matters when talking about autonomous vehicles. And you kind of play with that language in the title of your book with Autonorama and then Futurama. How do you define AVs and why do you see that label as paradoxical?
I agree with you really a great deal. That language matters enormously in this. I mean, to start with the term autonomous vehicle, you get the impression from that name that the vehicle itself is making all of the decisions. Of course, the vehicle is not making any decisions except the decisions that have been programmed into it. So, you know, whether it's going to be risk averse or take chances, whether it will steer around something or brake for it. These decisions were all made by human beings who decided how the car would drive. So the term autonomous vehicle is misleading in the sense that there really are human beings deciding how the car will behave in every situation. Now, the book's title is also about words too, and it's a fusion. It's a fusion of two words, Futurama and autonomous. And Futurama itself has an interesting history. It's a fusion as well. It's a fusion of future and diorama because way back in 1939, General Motors thought the way to sell a future where everybody would need a car was to present it very attractively. And so they developed an enormous, almost acre-sized model. It's future diorama or Futurama for the World's Fair of 1939. And we've had versions of that vision ever since. I think we're on the fourth generation of this Futurama vision. And so I just fused the word Futurama and autonomous to come up with Autonorama.
I imagine you wish you could teleport back to the New York World's Fair in 39 and ride on that Futurama exhibit. You do such a brilliant job of explaining what that ride was like, but just giving us a glimpse of what the future of roads and transportations look like for those people sitting in this seat in 1939.
Yeah, so if you go back that far, about a half of American families didn't even own a car, and especially in the New York area where most of those visitors were from. And so you had to stand in a long line because it was a very popular ride. And then when you finally got seated, a chair car, they called it, moved you along over the model and you viewed it down below you as if you were looking through an airplane window. That was deliberate. It was like a flight into the future. And down below, and narrated by a soothing voice telling you what you were seeing, you could see the city of 1960, the wonder world of 1960, as they called it. That's 20 years in the future. And in the city that you saw below you, there were actually little cars moving in slots on the roads. And everybody was driving everywhere for everything with no traffic jams, no crashes, and no parking problems, because these little vehicles didn't have to park. They just went around and around on the track forever. So it was a beautiful, attractive world of where cars really did everything and where you didn't need anything else. And there really wasn't anything else. Every trip was in a car. And so that was a future that was being sold to people. When you got off the ride, an attendant gave you a little button to wear that said, "I have seen the future." And so it was very specifically selling one vision of the future that is still being sold to us today.
We have Peter Norton with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia, talking about his new book, Autonorama. You can join in. Do you think we will ever get to self-driving cars? Or do you think it is out of reach? Have you ever ridden in an experimental autonomous vehicle? 800-642-1234. Peter, what is the draw from this industry and from car manufacturers to get to self-driving or autonomous vehicles?
So, well, the way they say it is that it's the way to get to zero crashes, zero emissions, and zero congestion. That's actually the title of a General Motors report, and that's still their vision, and it's also shared by other companies as well. And so it's, in that sense, it's very attractive. As you mentioned, 37,000 Americans are killed approximately each year on the roads. And so if you can say that you have a solution to that problem, we should definitely pay attention to that, because that's clearly a catastrophe that we have to do something about. They also say that the vehicles will reduce congestion and that they will also be zero emissions vehicles. These are all good reasons to look very closely at the technology. My feeling, though, is that when you do look closely at it, it's not what it appears to be. I think the real purpose here is to perpetuate car dependency, because that's an extremely profitable business model. When everybody has to have a car, then everybody has to spend a lot of money to get a car. And that is very good if you're in the business of selling the car or selling the technology that makes the car semi-automatic or fully automatic. It's not a good goal if our purpose is sustainability, affordability, inclusiveness, and health.
And this thinking that we need cars, we want cars, that's the way we want to get around, that has, from what I gathered, been fed to us by the industry. And this coalition, the Intelligent Vehicle Highway Systems report and the coalition you talk about, you know, finds that people prefer cars over public transit, but that you really take that to task. Why isn't that true?
Well, actually, I want to be very clear. We do want our cars very much. But of course, that's because of the fact that most of us live in environments where we don't have good choices, right? So it's very hard to tell what people prefer. If there's nothing on the menu, or if there's only one thing on the menu, if you have a restaurant where there's one thing on the menu, you don't get to say, well, everybody loves this dish, because that's all anybody's ordering. Well, that's the kind of situation most Americans live in, where our choices are very poor. And therefore, if we choose to drive, I don't think it's fair for anybody to conclude, oh, well, obviously that's your preference because you chose to drive. And yet, amazingly, you find exactly that kind of defective reasoning in official reports from, say, every state department of transportation in the country. And it is also one of the reasons that's cited for selling us this autonomous vehicles future, is this assertion that this is what we all prefer. So yes, most of us do need our cars and do want our cars, but many of us would also like to have better choices. And if we did have those choices, we might also do something better for the country and the world in terms of sustainability and other benefits.
University of Virginia technology historian explaining the history, the storylines of cars in America that have led to this push for autonomous vehicles. Do you want AVs on your city's roads and highways? Do you have a car out of necessity? Do you see a future where you'd get rid of it? Do you think self-driving cars are worth the cost? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Peter Norton here on the Ideas Network. GM has committed itself in recent years to zero crashes, zero emissions, zero congestion. We're talking about the promises of high-tech driving, what can be delivered here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here is GM's CEO, Mary Barra, in conversation with the CEO of Goldman Sachs in spring 2018, who asked her about timeline.
So let's say 5 years from now, will it feel natural or not unexceptional to look over, be at a stop at a traffic light, look over and see nobody in the front of the car?
I believe yes.
Wow.
So do you think driverless vehicles are, quote, just over the horizon? Are the investments in this technology worth it? 800-642-1234. University of Virginia's Peter Norton studies the past and future of urban mobility with us for the hour. Peter, you hear that exchange with GM CEO Mary Barra, who is so sure that this is just about to happen. But you really look at it in 20-year timeframes. Can you explain the horizon that the AV industry puts out there?
That's right. Horizon is exactly the right word, too. As long ago as that first Futurama in 1939, General Motors was literally telling people, this was like a slogan for them, there's always another horizon. And they used the word frequently. In fact, the exhibit was held in a larger pavilion called the Highways and Horizons Pavilion. And the horizon metaphor is a really interesting one because, of course, as you approach a horizon, it recedes. In other words, you never actually reach a horizon. It always recedes before you. And if the vision on the horizon is attractive, the sort of cliche about being in the desert and seeing a mirage that looks like an oasis of water at the end, that will keep you walking in that direction. And even though that mirage will constantly recede, its attractions will keep you going until you get so skeptical about it because you've been disappointed so much that you stop believing. So I think, we should be asking ourselves, why do we keep believing these promises that some kind of technological bliss is always right on over the next rise on our ascent up this slope? And I find that the thing that keeps being used to get us to believe again is the latest and the greatest technology that comes along, whatever it is. Every generation has it. In the 60s, it was transistors. In the 80s, it was microprocessors. Now it's machine learning and LIDAR and connectivity. These amazing technologies really are amazing. And because they really are amazing, they have a kind of power that resembles magic. Arthur C. Clarke, the author of 2001, A Space Odyssey, said the latest technology always seems indistinguishable from magic. Hmm. And I think that was a very keen insight. He was an engineer himself. And because of that magical quality, you remember some of us remember the first time we did a Google search or used an iPhone. It really did feel like magic, and it makes us believe anything's possible. And this is why I think we continue to be susceptible to these promises, even though none of them have ever held up at all.
Let's bring on a caller to probe that area of technology a bit more. Eric now in Phillips. Hi, Eric.
Yes, hello. My comment is I own a Tesla that has the full self-driving beta. I'm in northern Wisconsin. And the beta is supposed to be able to drive me from point A to point B on city streets. And when I watch the videos on YouTube in Arizona, it's amazing. And yet I throw in a little bit of winter snow up here and I get 15 disconnects in 1 mile. It's totally useless. So I look at that and go, why? I mean, I bought the car to be an EV, not a full self-driver. And it was used. It has it. And my honest opinion is a good level 2 with lane and keep assist and adaptive cruise is good. I think the main push for this actually is a little more perverse. I think it's the good wages that semi-drivers are making, and the full self-driving ultimate push, but follow the money, is to get rid of the semi-drivers. That's my opinion on where the follow the money is on this.
Oh, wow. There is so much to unpack there, Eric. Thank you so much. Peter, go ahead.
What an interesting series of observations there, really. I mean, to start with the fact that the technology's performance varies a lot by conditions. The most impressive sensor technology we've got is LiDAR. It's quite expensive, and it works very well in Arizona, suburban Phoenix, where it's used by Waymo, but it doesn't work well wherever, you know, as in most of the country, we have rain and snow. All of the sensor technologies have weaknesses of various kinds. You can combine them. That's expensive to offset the weaknesses. But, you know, the sensors don't work reliably under all conditions. And the closest we can do it to achieve something like a human capacity for sensing is to combine all of those systems, multiple LiDAR arrays. And that's so expensive that even Waymo won't tell anybody just how much one of their vehicles cost. Now, about what's behind this, I think that's an astute observation that the pay for a human driver, whether it's of a big semi rig or of an Uber or something like that, is a big incentive to develop these systems. And because it really can automate some kinds of driving pretty well. For example, a long distance big rig on an interstate highway, that's a relatively simple automation problem, at least after it gets on the highway and until it gets off, at which point it becomes complicated again. So I agree that's part of it. I think there's a lot more. For example, the people developing these systems are very enthusiastic about the possibility of being able to collect a lot of data from the vehicle occupants. So right now there's two points when it's hard to collect data from us. One is when we're sleeping and the other is when we're driving, because that's when we can't be on our phones. And so the hope for a lot of the tech companies is that once we're not having to pay attention to the road, we will all be immersed in entertainment and other kinds of technological pursuits that will generate a lot of monetizable data, and that's where they'll get their money.
We're talking with Peter Norton, who's an associate professor of history in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia, talking about autonomous vehicles. You can join in 800-642-1234. Eric brought up the video he watched in Arizona, and in 2018, Elaine Herzberg, the pedestrian killed by an AV in Tempe. What happened and what did that mean, that moment mean for the industry, that tragedy?
So I think that was a profoundly significant moment in a lot of ways. So yeah, this is March 2018, and Uber, in what Uber and the car maker Volvo called autonomous mode, was on another routine trip, one of many that this particular Uber driver had been on. And she had autonomous mode engaged, which meant that she was supposed to be supervising the car, but the car was really doing everything for her. And for that reason, and because this is one of many such trips this particular driver had taken, her attention was low. I don't think that reflects particularly badly on this driver, whose pay was low enough to deter Uber from admitting what it paid her. They refused to say, which signals that the pay was probably rather low. And also this was a real test of human cognitive capacities, in the sense that people are not very good at paying attention to nothing for a long time.
We zone out.
That's exactly right. That's the term. And this happens whether we want to or not. If you ask somebody to watch nothing for an hour, they will zone out. And that's predictable. Uber knew this, just like everybody with common sense knows this. And it had been an event-free trip for a very long time. In effect, what was happening was that the technology was doing everything that's easy for people to do anyway, like driving the car routinely, while at the same time demanding that the human so-called safety driver do something that humans are not good at, which is pay attention to nothing. So when Elaine Hertzberg was walking her bike across a road in Tempe, the vehicle, the safety driver had zoned out. The vehicle was not risk averse, and for a very important reason. So first, the vehicle detected Elaine Hertzberg almost 6 seconds before it struck her, and never did anything. Didn't slow down, didn't even apply the brakes until after it struck her.
We need to pause right here in this conversation, and really important one, with Peter Norton from the University of Virginia. You can join in on Driverless Cars 800-642-1234. We will pick this up after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at car dependency in America and the unfulfilled promises of driverless technology. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One of the many voices in this timeline, former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao, who said in the summer of 2018 in conversation at Fortune's Brainstorm Tech Conference, self-driving cars are coming, but like when?
A lot faster than what some people think, but not as fast as others.
So quantify that, please.
What role should the government play in pushing for autonomous vehicles? What should transportation regulators do to ensure safety but not stifle innovation? 800-642-1234. Peter Norton is the author of Autonorama and associate professor at the University of Virginia with us for the hour. Peter, I want to make sure we put a bow here on the Arizona situation, because, you know, when I read about the AV striking the pedestrian, like seconds before, the computer keeps like recalibrating and like doesn't recognize there is a human there. That's a human who is moving. Our brains as humans, we don't need to recalibrate. We get that. We would slow down or move to another lane. We'd react. So what happened?
The computer tried to figure out what it was detecting and then decided it was wrong and then detected it again. It was like it had no memory of the previous detection. So it would sort of begin to recalculate what it was observing. And you're exactly right. That's not how we would observe something. We might not be sure what we're looking at, but we recognize whatever it is as a continuous thing. It's not a new thing each second or so, as it was to the computer. Now, to be fair to the computer, to the technology, it would be possible to develop sort of robotic systems that do recognize that this thing is a continuous entity and not something brand new each second. But that wouldn't change the fact that the people programming these cars have to program them to take chances, because if they program them to be absolutely risk averse, they would have to drive so slowly and brake so often that no one would pay a dollar to ride in one.
That's really interesting. So that in order to not get us to be like, oh, that's a waste of time, we're not going to ride in something like that that goes that slowly or that keeps stopping every 2 feet, the industry has to forge ahead and take those risks.
Exactly. So a sort of conflation I keep hearing from the people promoting the vehicles is they talk about how safe they theoretically can be, which is extremely safe, and then they equate that with how safe they really will be. And of course, they know, and the rest of us need to know, that as a business necessity, they will make these cars take chances, because if they make them incapable of taking chances, they just won't be useful.
Let's bring on Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. So I just had a question about the car insurance industry. I mean, if I was in a vehicle like this and there's an accident, is that really going to be my fault? I just wonder how this might upend the car insurance industry.
Well, the car insurance industry is very interested in this for exactly the kind of reasons you're talking about. At first, it was because of the claims that there would simply be no more crashes. and which, you know, quickly proved to be unfounded. And the insurance industry was very interested in whether that's where they were heading, because their whole business is predicated on the assumption that there will be crashes. And then the next problem they were concerned about is whether the crashes would be so rare that they would still, in effect, lose their business. And they quickly decided that wasn't true either. And they even, as one of them told me, said that there's new possibilities because the technology is so expensive on these vehicles that in the event of a crash or even just exposure to the elements, some of these systems will degrade and need replacement insurance, and insurance will be there to provide for that. For example, the LIDAR array on a car equipped with LIDAR, that can be as expensive as the car itself. And so, insurance has something to offer to this development as well, and they're very closely engaged in it.
Eric, thank you. Rich now in Rhinelander with a question about public and private partnerships. Rich, go ahead.
Well, I'm smiling somewhat cynically. I mean, I'm not anti-tech by any means, but even now we're arguing about how much taxpayers are willing to pay for development of infrastructure. And I can't imagine that Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and other billionaires are going to say, here, take my billions or trillions of dollars. This is totally a private enterprise production. I think the prospect of autopilot cars seems cost prohibitive to me from a public standpoint.
Rich, thank you for that. Peter?
Well, even conventional cars are so expensive that the only way it was possible for this country to develop such a degree of car dependency was for taxpayers to assume the burden of making it possible. By that, I mean, the gas tax has never really paid for our road infrastructure. And that fraction that it does pay for has been declining for decades. And this means that, in effect, we've made it a national responsibility to make sure that this expensive way of getting around is also something that, serves everybody. In other words, we make sure that you can always access a destination by car, even if you can't access it by any other means. And that's been very expensive. And that precedent suggests that if we do proceed towards an autonomous vehicle future, the expense of making that possible will be very substantially a public expense. For example, the infrastructure that will make autonomous vehicles work, if it ever does, is going to have to be well equipped because the vehicles alone don't have everything it takes to work. And then that infrastructure, of course, is a public responsibility. So we're, of course, leaving people out who can't afford even to be ride sharing like as they would in a taxi right now in an autonomous vehicle, let alone buy one. We could have a transport system that recognizes transport as a public utility that should be provided, like water services, and then it could be much more equitable, which is incidentally what American cities had before car dependency, when it was a matter of public policy that the electric street railways were 5 cents. And so, in other words, the state ensured that you had an affordable way to get around, even if some people preferred to pay more to buy their own car.
What about toll roads and autonomous vehicles? What is that type of intersection?
Well, technology can do wonderful things for us. It's easy for a message like mine to be mistaken as an anti-technology message, and it's not at all. It's just suggesting that we choose to use the technology for what it's best able to offer us, and I don't think we're doing that now. But the technology could make tolling work in such a way that people are actually charged the cost of providing the road capacity that we actually use when we drive. And then a fraction of that tolling could be used to promote more affordable, more sustainable, more healthful modes of mobility, like transit, like cycling, like walkability. And we could really develop the choices we lack now with some smartly applied tolling.
We're talking with Peter Norton, who is with us, history of cars, car dependency in America. With your thoughts as well, do you think self-driving cars could be worth it economically? 800-642-1234. Peter, we talk a lot on our program about this transition to electric vehicles and the charging and the battery life and range anxiety. But this was really quite sobering. If the electric grid would have to electrify all these AVs in a society where we drive everywhere, we live farther away from the places we need to get to because it's an autonomous vehicle, we're doing other stuff, what would that mean for carbon emissions?
Well, we need electric vehicles, and so that I think there's no question about that, given the climate emergency that we're facing. What's troubling to me and to many others is the is when this gets presented as the solution. In other words, we can have the car dependency we have now. We just have to make sure that all of the cars are electric cars, and then it will be okay, which is not at all true, and for mainly for the reason you just mentioned, which is right now maybe a quarter of our electric power grid in the U.S. comes from renewable sources of energy, like wind and solar. And if we want to get that 25% up to 50%, and we really have to get it up to 100% eventually, then we will have to reduce the demand on the power grid at the same time. Otherwise, there's just no way to pull it off. Mm-hmm. And so if we have car dependency and we're driving as much as we are now, we'll actually be increasing the load on that grid and thereby defeating our efforts to improve or increase the share of renewables in the grid mix.
Let's go to Glenn now, joining us from Glendale. Hi there, Glenn.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. What is on your mind?
Well, I wanted to find out if there was already any discussion on the drinking under the influence and how self-driving cars would, you know, if those people would still be able to get out and drive their cars or if the self-driving cars would absolve them of being responsible for what the car does.
Glenn, thank you for that question. Peter, what about that?
It's a very important point. In fact, one of the selling points for autonomous vehicles is that they drive without ever being under the influence of alcohol or other drugs, and therefore will be safer and also will be a safe means of mobility for somebody who has had too much to drink. Of course, we will have at least as much access to taxis or Ubers to serve that purpose as we will have for autonomous vehicles for a long time to come. On the other hand, though, the robotics that drive autonomous vehicles is really not up to the job of replacing a human driver for that purpose and won't be for a long time, if ever. So we've spent, the experts say, about $100 billion developing autonomous vehicles. And so far, as one of your callers pointed out, that's working great for Phoenix or suburban Phoenix, but not much for the rest of the country. And so we have a tough question, which is, do we continue to commit that much resources around something that has delivered so little when we do have things that work for people in that kind of a situation already?
And we're going to look at those solutions with technology historian Peter Norton, new book, Autonorama at the Intersection of Where Old-Fashioned Car Dependency Meets AVs and this inevitable solutions filled with lots of squishy tech terminology. Do you buy into it? Are autonomous vehicles within reach? Are car companies, do you believe them? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Technology historian Peter Norton traces the empty promises of eliminating gridlock and improving transportation in America through the deployment of autonomous vehicles. And he's been explaining this history of what he calls the drive everywhere, drive only city vision and how it came to be. What is your vision for transportation in the future? What do you want it to be? Still time, 800-642-1234. Peter Norton's book is Autonorama. He's with us for nine more minutes. So here it comes, Peter. What are the proven transportation alternatives that are, as you say in your book, that are simpler, less expensive, less polluting than what can be delivered on par with these high bar autonomous vehicle promises?
There are so many things we could do that are less expensive, simpler, feasible with the technology that we have right now, and that will actually give people more choices and not fewer choices. Sometimes proposing things besides more car dependency can sound like taking choices away, because it sounds like someone saying you can't drive anymore. And actually, I think it's a much more positive situation that we're in than that, because what we can do instead is make many attractive alternatives to driving that will attract some people away from driving. Others will continue on less congested roads because of the fact that some people will have found choices they prefer. And those choices can take a lot of forms, some of them high tech, some of them very low tech. They can take the form of more public transit that actually is so reliable and so attractive and so convenient that it actually works well and attracts people to it. Yes, that would be quite expensive. On the other hand, it would be much less expensive than accommodating every person in a car right now, which is our national priority in the status quo. But that's not the only thing. We can also make attractive bike lanes, separated bike lanes, so that people who feel anxious cycling near cars will actually take up the bike again. We can accommodate and perhaps even incentivize and promote electric bikes, which have wonderful possibilities because they are so much more feasible than electric cars. And yet they also enable people who are maybe not physically fit enough to bike, or maybe have steep hills or long distances to navigate. And an electric bike could make that all work very nicely for them. We can integrate these systems well. For example, we can have electric vehicles that need no batteries because they draw their power from overhead wires. Those could take the form of electric trolley buses without rails or electric streetcars. Yes, those are expensive too, but when we look at the subsidies that electric vehicles are going to qualify for, it's interesting to think about what that could do for electric rail services in denser areas. And those services could be integrated with bike share services, so that when you get to your station, then you can bike to your final destination from there. This is done in the Netherlands every day. Many people get to work every day that way. The same card that you use to ride the electric train could also get you that bike. There's a lot of wonderful things we can do. Some of them are actually just almost no-brainers, like permit a local grocery store or convenience store to open up in a residential subdivision, which is usually illegal now. Hmm. But if it did, the neighbors could walk there or take their bike there, and it would be a win for everyone concerned.
So the mix there, the mix of solutions is already here, and some of these aren't, you know, don't involve really advanced new technologies. Jack is joining us from Madison. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi there. So I'm not sure how much of the discussion has revolved around, I guess, trains and specifically passenger rail and high-speed passenger rail as an alternative means of transit, especially to people who have been driving for as long as they can remember. And so my question for the speaker is, where do you see things going with rail as an alternative means to transit, particularly driving?
That fits in well, Jack. Peter?
Rail has great possibilities. So everyone seems to agree that we need to go electric. And the best way to go electric, if you want to move a lot of people or goods, is on rails. There's the low rolling resistance means that you need much less energy per, let's say, passenger than you need in a car. And you can have spatial efficiencies as well. And a real beauty of electric trains is that they don't need the batteries that electric cars do. And the battery is a really difficult problem when you recognize that The cobalt for them comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the labor conditions are appalling. The lithium would have to come from the Atacama Desert of Chile, where the consequences for local populations are pretty dire for supplying that much lithium. But we don't need all of those metals if we have electric vehicles that don't need batteries, and electric trains could serve that purpose. The money we've been pouring into highways, if a fraction of that went into rail, I think we could all see attractive rail services that we would welcome.
Jack, thank you for that. I want to land here on a question from Allison in North Prairie, sent us an email. And there's this line in the book that you quote someone, and I'm not exactly sure how it goes, but data being the new oil, extract crude data, and then you refine it for profit making. And Allison, along those lines, is asking, is there a risk of all this data? Is there a risk of hackers in autonomous vehicles? Is it possible to take control of an autonomous vehicle remotely?
It's such an important question, and there's really two parts to it. One is the illegal access to the vehicle, to the data, and to the control of the vehicle. And that is a real risk. It's a risk that gets a significant amount of attention and that is quite possibly manageable. For example, the vehicle might simply shut down if a certain tripwire is set off. To me, I think the much more troubling risk with the data is the perfectly legal access to it, because the people developing and promoting these vehicles, especially the tech companies, are telling each other, they don't tell us this, but they tell each other this, that these are going to be massive data collection boondoggles. And just as they addicted us, or many of us, to phones as a way of getting us to generate monetizable data for them, they are already explicitly talking about enticing us to spend more time than we planned in our autonomous vehicles while we're immersed in attractive games or other forms of entertainment, which they will use to collect data from us. They are the ones, Intel, for example, its CEO said that data is the new oil, and the vehicle occupant of the autonomous vehicle is going to be the oil well. And they will extract the data for their clients, and it will make a lot of money for them.
Mm. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kate. Thank you for your interest.
Peter Norton, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. New book, the author of Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.